From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Clarence Williams III. In the new film, Tales from the Hood, he plays a mortician who scares the heck out of three young drug dealers. Over 20 years ago, he played Link Hayes in The Mod Squad, about the adventures of three undercover hippie cops. We'll find out the true story behind Link's afro. Also, we meet writer-producer Stephen Cannell. He created the TV series The Rockford Files, The A-Team, Hunter, and Wise Guy. He's just published his first novel. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the George Gershwin Memorial Concert, the original radio broadcast of a 1937 tribute to the composer held shortly after his death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court has ruled that Congress is limited by the same standards as states are when it comes to affirmative action. The ruling has the potential to reduce or end federal programs for minority small businesses. Patricia Ireland is the president for the National Organization for Women. She says members of Congress will now be under particular pressure to get rid of affirmative action altogether.
The moderates and the progressives are going to have to not back down, not say, public opinion's against us, the Supreme Court's against us. They're going to have to make this part of the agenda in 1996, because I think there's every indication that women voters and people of color are paying attention to this.
The White House says it's trying to gauge the impact of the ruling. The Clinton administration is reviewing plans now in use. In a second case, the justices have ruled that low student test scores alone do not warrant court-ordered desegregation plans. The court says test results alone showing lower minority achievement than the national rate can only be a small part of deciding whether to go on with court-ordered desegregation. President Clinton says training and technology paid off in Bosnia. He praised the military today at a special Pentagon ceremony honoring rescued Air Force Captain Scott O'Grady. He spent nearly 6 days hiding from Bosnian Serbs after his plane was shot down. O'Grady says he is overwhelmed by the response he's received on his return from hiding, and he adds there's one more gift that he'd ask for.
The greatest gift that anybody could ever give me would be to, if you know anybody who's ever served their country in NATO or the UN or the United States of America, or who is serving it right now, is to go up to them and thank them for what they're doing, for trying to make this world a better place.
O'Grady says he accepts the honor he's being given on behalf of all serving NATO and in the United Nations peacekeeping force. The European airplane consortium Airbus has outdone its U.S. rival Boeing by announcing new orders totaling some $1.5 billion. The announcement was made today at the Paris Air Show. Lynn Terry reports.
Airbus said it's received new orders from Germany's Lufthansa and from Air Canada for 30 of its A319 airplanes. Lufthansa is taking 20 of the planes, which seat about 125 people, and the rest is going to Air Canada, making it the biggest operator of Airbus planes in North America. The announcement is a boon for the four-country consortium, which has complained that its sales have been hurt by the weak dollar and lobbying for Boeing by the U.S. government. Boeing and Airbus are fighting to increase sales in a sluggish market. On Sunday, Boeing announced that it had sealed about $560 million worth of orders for its B-737 twin jet. That's less than half the amount sold by Airbus. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 23 points at 4,447. This is NPR. The president of the AFL-CIO says he'll retire from the 80-union federation on August 1st. Lane Kirkland has held the labor movement's most visible post since 1979. He's now backing his deputy, Thomas Donahue, for the post, but a dissident group of union presidents still plans to release a slate of opposition candidates tomorrow. Donahue says he believes his experience at every level of organized labor makes him the consensus candidate. A 3-year-old agreement for the United States to buy uranium from dismantled Russian nuclear weapons is reportedly unraveling. Dick Hinchliffe reports.
According to sources speaking to the New York Times, the deal is coming apart because of trade disputes and disagreements over pricing the uranium. Under the agreement, Russia was supposed to receive $12 billion in hard U.S. currency in exchange for 500 metric tons of uranium from nuclear weapons. The uranium would then be diluted to create fuel for American nuclear power facilities to be converted into electricity. The U.S.-Russian deal was seen as a way to help Russia disarm and ensure the U.S. that nuclear fuel did not end up in the hands of hostile nations. Sources say the deal, first announced by the Bush administration, is now in jeopardy. The initial shipment of less than a ton of Russian uranium is scheduled to arrive in the U.S. this month. Additional shipments beyond the first 6 tons agreed to are considered unlikely. The Senate Energy Committee has planned a hearing on the issue tomorrow, and Vice President Gore intends to address the matter during his visit to Moscow later this month. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliff in New York.
A published report says a Los Angeles County Commission has found a hospital in Watts discriminated against non-black doctors. The LA Times reports the discrimination is part of the hospital's policy to, quote, maintain itself as a black institution. The LA County Civil Service Commission says MLK Hospital has used a variety of means, including inflating black doctors' test scores to carry out the unofficial policy. The commission is siding with an Indian-born doctor. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He started off playing a role model, but in recent years, Clarence Williams III has specialized in quirky, sometimes unsavory characters. From 1968 to 73, he co-starred in The Mod Squad, about three hippie undercover cops. More recently, he played a killer in 52 Pickup, an abusive father in Prince's film Purple Rain, and a heroin addict in Sugar Hill. He's great fun to watch in the new film Tales from the Hood. It's a comic horror film about three young drug dealers looking for a lost drug shipment at an address that turns out to be a funeral home. The mortician, who seems to come from the world of the dead, is played by Clarence Williams. He tells the dealers he'll get them the drugs, but first he opens up a series of coffins and terrifies the dealers by telling them the supernatural stories behind the death of each of the corpses. This is the scene in which Williams first meets the young drug dealers.
You know, this is all new to me. I'm not a drug dealer. I'm a mortician. The only drugs I know about are those that have to do with the deceased.
Yo, man, what kind of drugs do dead people be need?
All kinds. We shoot them real good with embalming fluid, mainly. You know what keeps them from smelling and decomposing before the surface.
Cool. Hey, so what happened to him?
Oh, they say he went crazy. Death. It comes in many strange packages.
Now, I read that you grew up over a funeral parlor, yes?
That's true. Well, not I lived over one. 135th Street and 7th Avenue in New York City in Harlem. There was a Griffin and Peters funeral home, which a lot of people may have seen because it was like four doors down from the world-famous Small's Paradise nightclub, where a lot of the magnificent jazz musicians through the years have played back in the heyday of the 40s, 50s, and part of the 60s. And my grandmother, she was an organist. And she used to play for funerals, and we lived. My sister and I lived with her for a part of the time, and we lived above the funeral parlor. And when you took the trash out, you'd have to go through the embalming room to the back alley to put it away. And so it was my first encounter with Grey's Anatomy without having Grey's Anatomy.
Were you impressionable and superstitious?
Not at all. And I don't know why. You know, it's true. It's an interesting question. I never really thought about it. I mean, it's sort of like. It's sort of like that's where I lived, and so it was normal. And plus, with my grandmother, obviously, you know, working in funeral parlors, because when I used to come home from school sometimes, because unfortunately, a lot of times, I mean, she was booked like four or five, you know, a day, and so she would go from one to the other, and sometimes I'd have to bring her lunch when I came home from school or early dinner, and I would bring it to the funeral parlor, and then I would wait, and she would play, because a lot of times, I remember this one particular funeral. Well, it wasn't a funeral; it was called the viewing of the body. And it was a man whose name I don't know, but evidently he was a big-time underworld-type figure. And his lady had passed away, and he had hired my grandmother to play music all day long. If persons were there or if they were not there, he wanted music playing while she was laying in repose, and had this big glass coffin of sort of Cinderella-ish. And so she was playing there, and that stuck in my mind. But it's the only time I really think about it. I never really thought about it that much.
So when you were young, though, you were constantly exposed to other people's tragedies.
Well, no, not really, because, I mean, I didn't spend my time around it. And also, interestingly, my grandmother played the organ for church services at the prison on Rikers Island and in New York City, the prison in the harbor. She played there for many, many years prior to her passing. But no, I mean, she didn't bring that stuff home. I mean, we'd never talked about it at home at all. And the only reason why I did see a bit of it from time to time, because we lived over the funeral parlor. But no, it wasn't a major thing in our lives at all.
Did you ever go with her to Rikers Island?
No. I was in school, and I was a child. I doubt seriously they'll let children go over there. And so, no, I never did. I do remember one thing. Her name was Helen, and she was very, very kind woman. And so she was out at Rikers Island one time at the church service, and she was playing the organ, and some of the guys were all sniffling and coughing and sniffling and coughing, and they were saying, "Oh, Mrs. Williams, you know, we have colds, and we can't get, you know, cough syrup and so on, so on, so on." And she was an impressionable lady, totally, totally devoid of any knowledge of underworld and nefarious activity. So the next week when she was going back out to the island to play for church services, she had stopped by the drugstore and bought inhalers and codeine cough syrup and all this. and she's going out to distribute this stuff to these people. And obviously she was a fixture going in and out of the place, so she's never searched or anything like that. But she presents this stuff to the guard. She says, "You must give this to the boys because they have colds." And the guard looks at this bag and he says, "Mrs. Williams, these are narcotics. We don't allow that stuff in here." And that's the kind of lady she was. I mean, one of the grand things that she did for my sister and I, so many, many years. My sister and I, we had a charge account, believe it or not, at a local candy store. And we could go in there and charge like $2 or $3 worth of comic books and a half a pint of, and back in those days, ice cream, they used to freshly dip it. You know, the guy would pack it right behind the counter. That's not like now, you just buy the carton already packed at the factory. But, and they would dip it. And it was a really great thing. And she was a wonderful lady.
Clarence Williams is my guest, and he's now starring in the film Tales from the Hood. So how old were you when you started to think about acting, and what made you start to think about it?
It started quite accidentally. I was way out of high school. I was maybe 2 years, not way out, but 2 years, about 2 years out of high school. And I was working here in New York at Gray Advertising Agency when they were at 430 Park Avenue. And I was working basically, in the daytime. They had two guys who were just not quite maintenance men, but sort of jack-of-all-trade kind of guys, and I was one of those. And I also served in the executive dining room for Mr. Fett, who was the president of the company at that time, and he had a private dining room when he had, you know, account people and prospective clients to come in and talk business, whatever. And so I would serve the dinner and the cocktails and all that sort of stuff. But they paid every 2 weeks. And being at that age, you know, money was not a serious thing to me, so I was always broke the second week. You know, budgeting was not a part of my vocabulary. And so I had a date to take a girl to a dance. And so I called my sister up, who was married at the time and living in Brooklyn, but she had a job working at the Harlem YMCA at night as a switchboard operator. And during the day, she worked for the hospital union, a local 1199. And so I called her and said, "I got to borrow $20 because I was going to this dance." And she said, "Sure, but you have to get here before, 5:30, before I get off work." And because she's going home to Brooklyn. I said, "Sure, no problem." And so I went by, and she gave me the $20. And obviously, that's all I had. And I had the date that evening, so I couldn't spend it or do anything. So she says, "They're rehearsing a play downstairs. Why don't you go down there and watch some of that?" And I said, "Sure." And I did. And so I went downstairs, and I opened the door, and the play was in, and the theater was in blackout, and they were having a run-through. So when I opened the door, this shaft of light shot across the auditorium, and the director was Vinette Carroll. And this voice boomed out, "Shut that GD door." And I shut the door. But I was on the inside and literally was too embarrassed to open the door and have this shaft of light shoot across the auditorium and disturb these people further to leave. So I crouched down in the back, and the run-through was over, and the house lights came up, and she turned around and she said, "Come here." And so I went over to apologize for having disturbed what was going on in this theater. And she says, "Are you an actor?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Would you like to be?" And I said, "Yes." And basically what I was saying was, I just wanted to placate her and just say, "Please forgive me for disturbing what you were doing." And so she says, "Well, go on stage and read these lines," which I did, and obviously read them not particularly well. And she came back and she says, "Okay, you have the part. Come to rehearsals tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And that's how it started. And I came in, and interestingly, in that production all either doing their very first or maybe second roles was Cecily Tyson, was Roscoe Lee Brown, was Isabel Sanford from the Jeffersons, all totally unknown people, and they were down there doing this play, Dark of the Moon.
So you started studying theater.
Yes.
As a young African-American actor, did you think that you would end up building your career in the black theater?
Well, I'd never really worked in the black theater, and I was never a member of the Negro Ensemble Company and all. Mm-hmm. So maybe I should fast forward then. So I started, and so I went and I auditioned for this play called Double Talk. It was written by Louis John Carlino, and it was produced by Cheryl Crawford. And Miss Crawford was one of the founders of the group theater and one of the co-founders of the Actor Studio. And so I walked in and I said, my name is Clarence Williams, may I see Miss Crawford, please? And the person says, just sign your name down here, and when Miss Crawford is ready to cast, you will get a notice that she's casting. So, and I said, okay, so I signed it down there, and a card came. I had an appointment at 4, whatever it was, in the afternoon, many weeks later, and I went down there thinking I had this appointment. I show up, and there's like 400 people there. It's in the cattle calls, is what they call it, and I was just included. And so everybody sort of like had 2 minutes or a minute or 30 seconds or whatever it was, next person. And so when I walked inside, Miss Crawford was behind her desk. She says, okay, what have you done? And I said, I played 2 leads at the Harlem Y. This made her laugh because everybody else is coming in blowing smoke about, well, I played Hamlet at Northwestern University and I did King Lear over here and I did this over there. And I was just totally straight and honest. I played 2 leads at the Harlem Y. And this lady leaned back in her chair and smiled. She said, sit down. And she talked to me for about a good 15 minutes, which is an awful lot of time out of her day. And so... make a long story short, they cast the play, and she tells me to come to the Martin Beck Theater, and I walk into Martin Beck Theater, and the play is all cast and everything. There's no jobs at all. And she just says, make Clarence the general understudy.
Wow.
And that was my first job, professional job on Broadway.
My guest is Clarence Williams. He stars in the new movie, Tales from the Hood. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Clarence Williams. How did you get from theater to television in your role as Link on the Mod Squad?
That came out of Slow Dance on the Killing Ground. Bill Cosby and his wife happened to be in New York, and he was on a break from doing I Spy. And they were in New York, and as anybody who knows anything about Bill, they know he's a big, big jazz fan. And so he was in New York, and they were seeing all the people who were playing in New York. And his wife said, I want to see a play tonight as opposed to going to listen to some music. So he said, okay, you pick one, and that's the one we're going to go. Camille Cosby happened to pick Slow Dance on the Killing Ground to come to see. And then they saw the play, did not come backstage, and left. And I don't know, but 2-3 months went by, and I get a phone call from Aaron Spelling, who was partnered at the time with Danny Thomas at Paramount Pictures in Hollywood, saying that they're sending me some airline tickets, and they want me to fly out to do a guest shot on the Danny Thomas Hour, which was an anthology series that Danny Thomas had at that time. And what it was, unbeknownst to me till after I got out to Hollywood, they said, this is a screen test for a series we're going to do called The Mod Squad, and you were recommended to us by Bill Cosby, and that's how that happened.
How did they first describe The Mod Squad to you?
Well, you know, something was called The Young Detectives. So it was called The Young Detectives, and these guys had, in the script, these guys were running around with all kinds of guns and machine pistols and this, that, and the other thing, and da-da-da-da-da. And all praises to Aaron. He was the one who wrote all of that stuff out. And he says, no, there's no guns, and there's not all of this sort of stuff. And which is interesting, I was somewhere, somebody was telling me how much they loved the show, and they used to love the shootouts we had. And Michael Cole, who was in the show, and Peggy Lipton, and Ty Gandrels, and myself, we never once carried guns, with the exception of Ty, who was really a policeman. In fact, the three of us were never really officially a part of the police department. We were sort of like these sort of juvenile delinquents who were being smoothed out to be better persons, but we never carried guns or had any shootouts or anything like that. But
you were undercover.
We were definitely undercover. Sort of like troubleshooters, and every now and then, when I can always tell when the writers were having difficulty coming up with a different show for us, is because they would always do. We bring out the old chestnut. Well, there's two chestnuts you bring out when the writers have a little trouble. The one is that the police commissioner is complaining to Captain Greer that these young kids are running around, and so you do that show about 2 times a season. And then toward the end of the year, when we're running low on funds because a few of the shows would go over budget, there'd always be some kind of murder at a theatrical studio so we could shoot one on the lot without going on location. So always some movie star who got knocked off or some makeup person who got knocked off, and the Mod Squad was brought in undercover, and so we wind up being a grip or a makeup person or something or other, or a script supervisor, and we solved the case. But that means, because that meant we could not go off the lot that for that particular episode, because we used to shoot 4 days out and 3 days in.
Now, you always used to say, Link always used to say, solid.
That came out of, I ad-libbed in the show, because that came out of, I used to hear a lot of jazz musicians would say to an individual who has just done such a terrific solo or made some really creative move with his or her instrument, and someone would say, solid. You know, and so I used that a couple of times. Then all of a sudden, it started appearing in a lot of scripts. And then I stopped using it because I didn't want to make it my hook or whatever they call it when you have a line that you're noted for. But nonetheless, it still stuck.
Were you able to tell, like, do you think one could tell looking back at the reruns what year it was in by your hair?
Yeah, of course they can. They knew it was in the late 60s. And that. Now, you know, it's interesting talking about that hair. I wore my hair long like that. Long before I was even an actor, my grandfather, after he came out of the Navy, for some reason, he rarely cut his hair. And his hair was always long. And I always just liked the look of his hair. So I stopped getting haircuts. Just totally stopped. Wasn't making any kind of political statement.
This is before the afro you were wearing.
Long before. Uh-huh. Long before. Ask anybody who knew me of the period, and they will all tell you that my hair was always that long. But I used to shave it all off in the summertime. And that was the only time during the year I would have a haircut. In the summertime, I would shave it all off, and then by the time it was coming to go to school again or whatever, when September would roll around, it would begin to grow back in and look, you know, have a semblance of normalcy as opposed to a shaved head. But no, it had nothing to do with any of that. But anyway, so I started, but yeah, the term, so all of a sudden they put this term afro to it. So it's called this afro. And I used to say to myself, well, the term is basically a misnomer, because if you had your hair, in fact, that long and you were living in the jungle, I mean, everything would be collecting in your hair. You would have bugs in your hair. I mean, if as you ran through the jungle chasing your equivalent of Jane, it would get snagged on trees and all kinds of things like that would happen to it. But that's how that really happened. And interestingly, when I first got out to California, and so and they decided that they were going to use me in the pilot for the television show, and so I was in Mr. Spelling's office, and he was sitting behind his desk and he was puffing on his pipe, and you can tell when Aaron is really thinking hard because the puffs on the pipe get more puffier, and so these puffs were puffing, and then all of a sudden he finally said, "We got to do something about your hair." So I said, "Well, what do you mean do something about my hair?" He says, "We got to do something about your hair." So what he did was, this is truly funny, and he says to, I think it's Shelley Hull, who was his assistant and still is, was there. And he said, "Shelley, where's Bill Cosby?" And so Shelley says, "I don't know, boss, but I'll find out." So he goes and he grabs a phone and he calls Sheldon Leonard's office, who was the executive producer of I Spy, and say, "Where's I Spy shooting?" And he said, "Well, they're down in Acapulco. They're shooting down there." He says, "Okay." So he comes, he said, "Down in Acapulco." So Aaron says, "Give me the phone number of where they're staying in Acapulco." Gets the phone number. Aaron Spelling calls Bill Cosby in Acapulco and say, "Hey, Bill, who cuts your hair? What's the name of your barber?" And to get Bill to come out to the studio to cut my hair. So, I mean, they got a big brouhaha about this hair. So this guy comes to the studio to cut my hair, and I really, truly didn't want this haircut. So I said, "Okay, I'll get this haircut." So he and I go into one of the dressing rooms alone, which was perfect. And I said, "Now, here's what I want you to do. Just trim it. Just trim it, trim it, trim it. That's all. Make it trim. Not a lot." And then I went into the bathroom, and I just soaked it all the way wet, totally through. Then I came back and he had some kind of pomade. And I said, "Now put some of that stuff on it." And then we packed it and combed it down, really packed it down tight. Then went back into Mr. Spelling's office and he says, "Hey, that's better. I said, "No, I don't take any more off." He says, "Okay, well, stay with that." So now when we start shooting the shows, each time I would tease it out just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, until it became what it became, and which was the way I used to wear it.
This is a very important story in American culture, I think. So listen, of all the people who you went undercover as, what was your favorite?
I don't have a favorite, but there were some favorite people who were doing the show at that time. And
oh, like Sammy Davis?
Sammy Davis was a joy, but I was thinking about, in another thing, because with Sammy, basically, we played ourselves.
Right.
But I was like Maurice Evans. I was he played an admiral, a retired admiral, and my undercover thing was to be this admiral's aide. And that was a lot of fun because he has Maurice Evans, who represents a great deal of the English theater and the Shakespeare and all of that, and it was a joy to work with him for the 7 days that he was there.
So were you glad or sorry when the Mod Squad came to an end?
Well, I wasn't glad and or sorry, and it didn't come to an end in the kind of way that normally shows come to an end. My contract was up, and I would not renew. The show was never really canceled in the sense that, guys, the ratings are no good, so it's over. I'd done my 5 years, and I decided I had done that long enough, and so I said, that's it for me, and I went back to New York, and then they decided not to continue with it.
I see. Now, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you were this really good role model, right, in Mod Squad.
That was Perceptions.
But then after that, most of the roles of yours that I know, you've been killers, abusers, people who are really nuts. I mean, that was kind of it for your good role model era.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, and those were the kinds of parts that put me in feature films. And the
crazy parts.
Well, the guys were not so crazy. They had a different point of view. And the one that turned it for me was John Frankenheimer.
Oh, 52 Pickup.
Yeah, and Mr. Frankenheimer, I think probably is all credit is due to him for my quote resurgence end quote.
Oh, okay. Well, let me say that's where I started noticing you again.
Yeah.
Let me play a clip from 52 Pickup so people can hear how you sounded in it.
Sure.
Hey, come on, what is this? Don't be fooling with guns in here.
You ready for the big question?
Oh, man, what are you on?
The question is, how much did the man say he was going to give you?
Give me?
Give you. Give us. Just say it.
Yeah, you went out to see the guy, didn't you?
What's the answer?
I know, before I can talk to you, you go out on your own and see the guy yourself. Is that it? Hey, now, you... Listen to me a minute.
When a man pulls shit on me, he's either very brave or very stoned. Which are you?
Hey.
It's a clip from 52 Pickup, and my guest is Clarence Williams III. I'm going to make a confession to you, and I don't know how you'll take this, but after seeing you play the psychotic killer in 52 Pickup, playing the abusive father in Purple Rain, the really strange evangelizing cop in Deep Cover, Wesley Snipes' heroin-addicted father in Sugar Hill, I was thinking, well, Clarence Williams, man, he is really great, but I bet he's a pretty strange man. I mean, I want to interview this man, but I wonder if he's even sane, because you are so eccentric. What makes you so gifted at getting in touch with a certain type of character who has broken from reality?
I don't know how to answer that. I really don't. I don't know how to answer that.
I mean, you just have such a gift for it. I mean, I just think you're so remarkable in those roles.
I'm not trying to be disingenuous, but I think a great deal of the credit has to go to the writers. I mean, these people put the stuff on the page, and I'm bent or strange or whatever enough to be able to get in touch with it, but I really don't know how.
Are you glad to be getting roles that aren't those kinds of crazy
only
roles?
No, only because I don't mind playing those, but I'm obviously you want to, you know, to have a variety of work,
right,
and different characters to attempt to play, but I think it becomes important for me to try to do that, to be brutally honest, just from a business point of view, is that, you know, so people think of you in other terms. I mean, if people see me in real life, a lot of times they don't even recognize me because most of the time I have a suit and tie on.
Clarence Williams, he stars in the new film Tales from the Hood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After George Gershwin's death in 1937, musicians and singers paid tribute to him at a memorial concert. That concert, which includes this performance of An American in Paris, has just been released on CD. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And we meet the creator of The A-Team, The Rockford Files, Beretta, Hunter, and Wise Guy, Stephen Cannell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has released a series of administrative steps and legislative proposals designed to make government regulations on pension plans more simple. The suggestions are recommended by small business. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
In a speech to the White House Conference on Small Business, President Clinton proposed an IRA-based pension plan. It's called the National Employee Savings Trust, and it would exempt small business owners from stacks of government rules if they make a meaningful contribution to retirement plans or match voluntary contributions of employees. Mr. Clinton broke up the room when he spoke of other regulatory reforms his administration is working on, including one Mr. Clinton says he can personally relate to.
I hate to tell you this, folks, but we're about to lose the regulation that tells us how to test grits.
The pension reform plan is part of the administration's effort to reinvent government. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
The Occupational Health and Safety Administration says it will not issue rules covering repetitive strain injuries. Officials from the Labor Department say they will continue to work on developing regulations to protect workers. But they say draft rules are not sufficient to work on the problem. An OSHA spokeswoman says while a standard won't be issued now, the agency understands the problem must be addressed. OSHA says repetitive strain injuries affect more than 700,000 workers a year and account for $1 of every $3 spent on workers' compensation. A New York City police officer was arrested and 4 officers were suspended for participating in a bar brawl after a police picnic in New Jersey this past weekend. The city police department has already been tarnished by a scandal. Only last month, New York City police officers were involved in what's been described as by witnesses, as a drunken rampage in Washington, D.C., NPR's Margot Adler reports.
The incident took place in New Jersey over the weekend. Apparently bar hopping, an officer got into a fight with a bouncer. A police spokesperson said Officer Lisa Caliandro was arrested along with her husband. Officer Caliandro was charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. Her civilian husband was charged with assault. Officer Caliandro accused the bouncer of fondling her. The officer, along with 3 of her colleagues, all from a precinct in Staten Island, were suspended without pay. This disturbance comes only one day after New York Police Commissioner William Bratton announced a program to rebuild the department's image after last month's Washington, D.C. incident. In that so-called Animal House escapade, off-duty police officers slid down escalators naked and sprayed hotel fire extinguishers. One officer resigned in that incident, and 2 others were suspended. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
The United States and Japan have ended one-day talks on their car dispute. Geneva talks have ended with no sign of agreement, according to U.S. trade officials. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow rose 22.5 points to end the day at 4,446. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat has dropped his demand that negotiations with Israel be completed by July 1st. NPR Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Arafat met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Cairo today after weekend talks with Secretary of State Warren Christopher. The meetings took place after there was recent progress in long-stalled Israeli-Palestinian talks. While July 1st is no longer considered a deadline for reaching an agreement with Israel on transferring civilian functions, holding elections, and the redeployment of troops in the West Bank, wide differences between the two sides remain, despite some recent progress. The PLO continues to insist that Israeli troops deploy away from Palestinian towns at least a month before elections expected this fall. Israel has agreed in principle to the redeployment, but strongly disagrees with the PLO on when, where, and how the troop movement should take place. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
There have been two major rulings on race from the Supreme Court today. The justices ruled that in affirmative action matters, Congress is just as strictly limited as the states are in offering special help to minorities. The decision has the potential to cripple federal affirmative action programs. The justices have also ruled that court-ordered school desegregation does not have to be maintained until student test scores reach national norms. The Supreme Court says it's unfair to make students reach academic goals before desegregation plans can be stopped. The vote in both cases, 5-4. The Coast Guard says the luxury liner Royal Majesty will arrive in Boston later this afternoon, but a cruise that was supposed to depart Boston yesterday has been canceled. The vessel, with 1,500 people aboard, ran aground yesterday near Nantucket while returning to Boston from Bermuda. A high tide and six tugboats freed the ship last night. Officials say a check inside the ship shows minor buckling in the hull, but no leaks. The Coast Guard and the ship's owner say no one was hurt in the incident. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest must know what Americans like to watch on TV. He created such series as The Rockford Files, Beretta, The A-Team, Hunter, 21 Jump Street, Booker, Wise Guy, The Commish, and Silk Stockings. Stephen Cannell is a writer and producer who's run his own production company for the past 15 years. At a time when many Americans worry that television has replaced reading in our culture, Cannell has published his first novel. Not surprisingly, TV is one of the main characters. The novel is called The Plan, and it's about a mafia takeover of a TV network.
The Plan is a novel about an attempt by a mafia family to put a man in the White House. And the reason that they are attempting to do this is that they have realized in 1971 when the RICO laws were enacted, which, as you know, the RICO laws were the laws that basically said that if you have any prior knowledge of a crime, you're as guilty of the crime as if you committed it yourself. And these mobsters realize that that RICO law is going to put them all in jail, and they decide that they had better put a man in the White House. The purpose for that is they want to neuter the Justice Department. They want to put somebody in charge of justice or in charge of the FBI who is not going to prosecute underworld figures. And that's their plan. And the way they realize that they can accomplish this or attempt to accomplish it is by purchasing a television network and using the television network to control the very critical first 3 weeks of a primary campaign up through Super Tuesday, which will allow them to put their man in the White House, or at least to get the Democratic nomination in this case.
Stephen Cannell is my guest. He has a new novel called The Plan. One of the things we all know you for, and we know your name for, is your logo. Because at the end of your shows, there's your logo where you're tearing paper out of the typewriter and tossing it, and the wind kind of carries it, carries it off. Those logos, there's a lot of people doing logos like that now. I think they've come to be called vanity logos. Were you the first?
I probably was, and I did it for probably all the wrong reasons. One of the reasons that I wanted to do it was that when I set up my own studio, I was very concerned, because I do write every day for 5 hours, generally 5 hours every day. And I was very concerned when I set up my own studio, and it was a freestanding studio. It carried its own financing. I had no partners. It was just my wife and myself. And if we went down, we were going to lose our house over it. And when I started, I thought I was very concerned that I would start to be perceived as an executive instead of a writer. And so I had a publicist at the time who suggested that logo. And I thought, and I was probably vain enough to say, yeah, I'll put myself on television. So I did it. But it's turned out to be really a terrific thing, because there were times during the 80s when having that recognition was very helpful with financing that I was doing and kept my studio alive. And so it's actually served me very well.
How often do you get to write for your own shows now? You have so many shows.
I write for the ones that need me. When a show goes on the air, I usually write. I'm one of the staff members of the show, if I created it especially. I'm one of the staff members for probably the first year at least, and sometimes a year and a half. And by that, it means that I'm in the rotation with all the other writers. If we have four writers on the staff, then I'm up for every fourth script, roughly. And I try and do that. I usually write about 10 scripts a year, and so I fill in on other shows that need me. Sometimes, since I write fairly quickly, the executive producers of other shows of mine will come down the hall and say, "We're in trouble. We need something in 3 days, and would you mind grabbing, a script and banging it out for us?" And so I'll do that, and I do a lot of that sort of utility infield work, you know. But I really love to write, so for me, that's not a chore. That's something I'm really happy to be asked.
Let me ask you about one of your series that was one of my favorite series of the 1980s, though it maybe drifted into the 90s as well. I'm thinking of Wise Guy.
Yeah.
Which, the things that made that show really good were, the writing and the performances. You got some terrific actors on there. Kevin Spacey, Ron Silver, Jerry Lewis, Ray Sharkey, all doing these, like, long guest shots because an arc, a series within the show would take, like, 6 or 7 episodes.
Right.
So let me actually formulate this into a question.
I bet I can guess it, but go ahead.
Okay, why don't you just ask it yourself?
You're probably asking, you probably want to know, like, how did that happen and how did it, thing about Wise Guy.
What is the antecedent for it?
How did it happen that I had the antecedent is, how did it happen that you had a show that ended up being told in story arcs of 6 episodes instead of just being, because that was really what was unique about the show was that it was a series of miniseries.
Exactly, right. And unlike Hill Street Blues, which would just continue for a whole season, this would just go for 6 or 7 episodes. But you'd have to see all 6 or 7.
Well, yeah, and we tried to make it so you could miss a couple, so and it would still make sense to you. But what I was very intrigued when I came up with that idea initially with one thing. I thought, what would it be like? Because it was really more about the moral gray areas of the hero than anything else. And I said, what would it be like to be a police officer making $35,000, $40,000 a year, and all of a sudden you're going undercover? The OCB, the Organized Crime Bureau, the FBI, puts you in a federal prison as a roommate with somebody and some wise guy. And when he gets out, you get out a month later, and now you're buddies, and all of a sudden you're in the mob. Somebody's flipping you the keys to a Porsche Targa and saying, "Hey, drive this while the owner's still in jail, and you can use his apartment, which is a penthouse at the top of some beautiful building, and you're going to hang out with glittery people." And I thought that would be very, and so I further, in creating the show, I further complicated that by giving him a handler in the OCB. His control agent was a guy he just didn't like. And the first guy that he went after was a guy that he had tremendous emotional attachment to and actually became almost like a brother to, so that when he brought him down at the end, it was one of the most traumatic things for him.
Is this the Ray Sharkey character?
The Ray Sharkey character. And the other thing that was really interesting about that show was that normally in an hour of television, the adversary in the play isn't given much time because you only have 47 minutes and 53 seconds. And so what this allowed me to do was to really go into the mind of the adversary, and the adversary became as important as the hero.
My guest is TV writer and producer Stephen Cannell. He's just published his first novel called The Plan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Cannell, the creator of such TV series as The Rockford Files, The A-Team, Wise Guy, Hunter, and 21 Jump Street. I'm interested in how you got your start in television. What was the first thing you wrote?
First thing I wrote that I sold was an episode of It Takes a Thief, starring Robert Wagner. And then I followed that with a couple episodes of Ironside. And then after I sold the Ironsides, I sold an episode of Adam 12. And again, I was just freelancing at this time. I was about 25, 26 years old. And Jack Webb's company put me under contract as the head writer for that show after that one script. And then that was sort of the opening of the door for me. I went to Universal and, you know, I drove on that lot the first day and I thought, boy, I can't believe I'm here. I finally made this. And I was on that show for about a year and a half. And then I created The Rockford Files and Beretta and a bunch of shows for Universal. And through Roy Huggins, I worked with Roy Huggins on those. And that sort of got me started.
So after several years at Universal, you were really quite successful. You decided to form your own company. What did you hope that your own company would give you that working for a studio would not?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things is that my father is an entrepreneur, and I grew up watching my father run his business. And my father's also my best friend and my hero. And I didn't think I had, because of my dyslexia, I didn't think I really had a businessman's mind. But as I got older and successful doing television, I began to sort of play with the idea, well, why shouldn't I own these negatives myself? I create the Rockford Files. I do the show for 6 years, and all I'm doing is paid a salary. And yet I know Universal's going out and selling that show for a lot of money, and that's money I'll never see, and even though I produced the show. Now, I didn't take the risk, the economic risk, so I understood that it was their profit to make and not mine. But I got to thinking, well, you know, why shouldn't I take that economic risk? I'm willing to take a risk. Why shouldn't I get the reward? So I decided to set up a company, and I was the first writer that I knew, the pure writer, that decided to take that chance, and that was 15 years ago, and we've done like 25 shows through my company.
I suspect as a head of the production company, you have to read a lot of scripts by people who write for your shows. Is it hard for you to read them quickly with the dyslexia?
Yes, yeah, Terry, it's very hard. I read about 250 words a minute, if that. I'm the slowest reader in my building. My script will come out and everybody will run to an office and say, we're going to have a meeting in half an hour, and they're all done and I'm still plowing through it. You know, it's been a horrible burden in my business life to be such a slow reader, because it just takes immense amounts of time. But I'm a voracious reader. I read constantly. I read other people's fiction. The reason that I wanted to write a novel is that I so admire so many novelists and because I read novels constantly.
Do you have to read your own writing slowly too?
No, I can read that probably about the same speed I read other things, because I know what's there. So, but I spell everything phonetically, and I spell very, very badly. And
do you spell checks now? Does that make it easier?
Doesn't work, because
but the computer can't recognize your words.
Doesn't
so
recognize
bad.
The words. I get a menu of words, and the word I've written is not in there.
Huh.
So I just decided, you know what, this is not my gift. Spelling, you know, my gift is in creative writing, and I will write these words so that they're readable, but I'm not going to spend half of my time that I have. I spend 5 hours a day basically writing. I'm not going to spend 2.5 of those hours looking things up in the dictionary. I'm not interested in how things are spelled. I'm never going to be better at it, because things don't look right to me. Because every time I see a word, I see it slightly differently. I've transposed a couple of letters. So my mother used to say to me, well, Stephen, doesn't that look wrong to you? Well, no, because when every time I see that word, I see it slightly differently. So nothing looked right or wrong to me. It's just a very confusing thing, you know, but.
Well, I have one last question for you. Have you ever thought of a TV series called Dyslexic Detective?
Yeah, who can't find any addresses and, you know, doesn't know where to go.
Right.
Doesn't know his right from his left. Yeah, that's a great idea, Terry.
I knew it would sell.
Make it a half hour, you know.
Boy, I bet people come up with bad ideas for you all the time.
Well, that one probably could be a pretty funny one if you decided to write it. But
we'll talk.
We'll talk. We'll talk. You have my number.
Stephen Kendall, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry, thank you.
Stephen Cannell is a TV producer and writer. He's just published his first novel called The Plan. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we're going to be hearing about two decisions today by the U.S. Supreme Court, decisions in two cases, both about federal affirmative action programs, cases that will probably limit the extent of affirmative action programs that will be undertaken in the future. Also, on this 1 year to the day after the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, we'll be talking with two people about what the impact of having the trial on television every day has been. Ira Glass, remember Ira Glass's coverage of Washington Irving Elementary School, mm-hmm. the school in Chicago? Well, last week we heard about their school trip to Washington. Today, yet another chapter about that trip.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. George Gershwin died of a brain tumor on July 11, 1937, at the age of 38. Both the New York Philharmonic and the Los Angeles Philharmonic presented memorial concerts. The L.A. concert was broadcast on the radio. That broadcast, a massive tribute at the Hollywood Bowl 2 months after Gershwin's death, has just been released on CD. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review.
The performers were stars from Broadway and Hollywood, opera and the concert stage. Al Jolson sang Swanee, the song he turned into Gershwin's first and biggest hit. Gershwin played a crucial part in the early Broadway career of Fred Astaire. Perhaps the greatest song Gershwin wrote for him was from his 1937 movie Shall We Dance? And when Astaire sang it at the Hollywood Bowl Memorial, it took on a touching, personal slant.
Our romance won't end on a sorrowful note, though by tomorrow you're gone. The song is ended, but as the songwriter wrote, the melody lingers on. They may take you from me, I'll miss your fond caress. But though they take you from me, I'll still possess the way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me, the way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away.
The classical world was well represented. Coloratura soprano Lily Pons warbled a rather bizarre version of Summertime with a thick Parisian accent. Glamorous metropolitan opera and radio star Gladys Swarthout sang a very classy yet impassioned version of The Man I Love that proved that George and Ira Gershwin really did write art songs. It was a long program. Gershwin's close friend, pianist and raconteur Oscar Levant, played a brilliant performance of Gershwin's Concerto in F, conducted by Charles Previn, Andre Previn's uncle. Jose Iturbe played and conducted Rhapsody in Blue. The most remarkable item is by the L.A. Philharmonic's great music director at that time, Otto Klemperer. He opened the concert with his own powerful arrangement of Gershwin's second piano prelude as a funeral march. It's Klemperer's only surviving performance of anything by Gershwin.
Thank you.
Besides Summertime, there were also extensive selections from Porgy and Bess, sung by members of the original cast, Todd Duncan, Anne Brown, and the marvelous Ruby Elsie, Gershwin's original Serena, who never made a commercial recording of anything from the show. Unfortunately, not everything performed at the Gershwin Memorial Concert can fit on a single disc, and Elsie's hair-raising My Man's Gone Now is one of the casualties of this new CD. Back in 1981, Michael Feinstein, the young friend of Ira Gershwin's who is now famous for his renditions of show music, produced an LP of this memorial concert that contained even less material, but it had the entire Porgy segment, including Ruby Elsie. Feinstein's source was Ira Gershwin's personal 16-inch records of the broadcast, so the sound was far superior to the tinny sound and occasional distortions on the new CD, which is also embarrassingly sloppy about names and dates. But the CD does have An American in Paris, Rhapsody in Blue, and all three movements of the Concerto in F, not to mention one even greater advantage. It's in print.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the George Gershwin Memorial Concert on the Radio Years label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel your love is real. Near you, I wanna be. The birds are singing, it is song time. The swallows playing soft and low. I know that you yearn for me too. Swanee, you're calling me. Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.